Welcome to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production. Hi, I'm Carol Bissett, a crime writer, and I invite you with my co-presenters, Liz Hedgecock and Mike Jackson, each week to our conversations on all things murderous.
Welcome to another episode of Only Murders in My Mind with the famous Liz Hedgecock.
Hello.
Mike Jackson.
Hi.
And today we have a guest speaker. She's been on before and we liked talking to her so much we've asked her back, Paula Hartman. Hi, Paula.
Hello.
I know last time we were talking about your co-writing with our friend here, Liz, and how well it went. But I want to talk to you today, and we'll all join in, about the books you write yourself. I mean, Liz, like you, has different books that she writes and has different series on your own. But your books, first of all, this is something you probably get asked this all the time, because when we do talks for libraries, we get asked this. Why did you start writing?
Oh, gosh. Well, because I wanted to. I think that
very
I
good answer.
Yeah, I when I was little, I grew up surrounded by books. Stories were just part of life, and I used to tell myself stories when I couldn't sleep when I was little, and as soon as I could write, I started writing stories. So I always thought that would be what my job would be, but it's obviously I got to adulthood and I actually had to pay the bills and realised it might not be the easiest thing to do. So I was dabbling but not doing anything with it. I lost some confidence. And then I got, you know, I had a career, I got married, I had children, and life just got in the way, really. What really happened, I was just doing it in the background, and a couple of people said, you know, whenever I mentioned it to them, they go, well, you'll never do that, will you? And I sort of thought, well, the part of me thought, yes, I will. The other part of me thought, no, probably won't, and felt a bit miserable about it. And then my dad died. And at his funeral, an old school friend turned up, and we'd lost touch with each other, but she and I had been the two little weird girls in the village. We told stories and we acted them out and all the rest of it. And she said, are you still writing? And this was 25 years. I hadn't seen her for 25 years. And I said, well, no, not really. Are you? And she said, yes, I am. It's my job. And she said, go on, get on with it, more or less. So I did. I thought, why am I wasting time? And one of the funny things is I used to have this dream, a recurring dream, a vivid dreamer, and I used to have this recurring one about being in a house, finding a door or a little hole in the floor or something, and walking into this other room, which I didn't know was there. And it was amazing, fantastic. There were loads of things in there. It's beautiful. And I was listening on the radio to somebody talking about it and talking about interpreting dreams. And I was sort of thinking, yeah, whatever. And then he said, what that means is that you've got an untapped creativity that you've just kept to one side, and you need to go and get it out. And the funny thing was, when I started writing again, that dream very rarely occurred. So I think it was probably true.
See, now my recurring dream is that I'm going to fail my history A-level. But I don't have dreams. I don't have dreams anywhere near as good as Paula. Paula has the best, like, weirdest dreams ever.
No, I do have the exam dream occasionally. I do wake up thinking, oh, good grief, I haven't read Henry the Fourth Part Four or whatever, you know. And I think, hang on, there isn't a Henry the Fourth Part Four, and I'm a bit past the exam age. But yeah, so that's why I started. And I think when I started, I had so much bottled up creativity that I hadn't done anything with, that I sort of wrote loads of short stories in a really short space of time, and those became my first two books that I did actually publish. And I knew that probably the world wasn't really going to be that bothered by them, but actually one of them does sell quite nicely. And I thought, yeah, that I'd sort of unbottled something and I wasn't going to look back.
The genie come out of the bottle, indeed.
What brought you to mystery and crime?
Well, because I'm a very upstanding citizen, if short.
Clearly, yes.
So obviously underneath the surface, I'm a secret murderer. No, I don't know. I always like, starting with the famous five and the secret seven, probably. Yes. I just loved mysteries. And I loved things like the, if I could get to watch them, the Lord Peter Wimsey ones with Peter Carmichael, partly because I thought he was attractive. But I just love the stories, and I don't know, I just love that little bit of somebody something nasty happening, but somebody sorting it out and resolving it. And yeah, it is. They are the sort of crimes I like reading and writing are the ones where there's a resolution. I know that that's not real life all the time, but it's nice to feel that then in the space of two covers, you do resolve a situation.
So I wrap my detective solve problems in 5 days. They're really good.
Oh, they've got modern technology. That's not
they have.
Fair.
They have got modern technology. Am I right in thinking you do a little bit of art as well?
Oh, dabble. Yes, I do dabble.
But we all dabble. We dabble, but we dabble, don't we?
Yeah, dabble. You go to. Yeah, I don't have anybody to go to a class with. I perhaps ought to find somebody. But yeah, no, it's a dabbling thing, and it's it's nice to do something where I'm not judging myself. I'm not thinking, oh, this has got to be perfect. I'm just getting some paint onto a paper or a bit scribbling something down. And sometimes I think, yeah, that's really good. I'm really happy with that. And sometimes I think, what a load of rubbish. But it's just nice to just unlock part of your brain. And I found it very relaxing.
Yes, it is. I find it as well. Liz said to me, it's Black Wax last September, wasn't it? Do you want to come to a sketching class?
Yes.
Yeah. And we've both moved on from that. But don't you think it's part of the creative flow? Because I do know other writers who do creative things apart from their writing. I mean, do you do anything else? Or do you just not get the time to do other stuff? I mean, you've got a busy life.
Yeah, haven't you? I used to do a bit of photography. I haven't done that for a while. I do like cooking. I used to absolutely love sewing, dressmaking, designing. Outfits and things like that. And I'm not really great skill, but I just really enjoy doing it. And I just got out of the habit of doing that, and I'd like to get back into it. My husband used to sort of say, "Oh, I just come in there and you're just sort of muttering at things because it's all going wrong." And I said, "But I'm quite happy. I'm just going, but I'm actually really happy while I'm doing it." And he said, "I don't understand it." But you know,
the dresses that have ended up in the bin that I've made, and I've gone, "It's a twill." When you were talking about nightmares, I love the sewing bee, but I do often, when it's on, get a nightmare of me doing my needlework O level, and I set a sleeve into an arm upside down under the pressure. So I really, you know, sometimes the sweat's pouring off me when I'm watching it. But the other thing I was going to ask you is, and again, this is something you've probably been asked before, and it's something we get asked. Have you got a particular pattern when you write? Is it just when you get the time? Do you have a particular time of day you write? People are interested. I'm interested.
Well, I think when I started, like I said, I had been putting it off, making excuses. I haven't got time. I haven't got space. I haven't got peace and quiet, blah, blah, blah. And I did think, no, you've just got to get on with it. And when I was doing... I did NaNoWriMo in 2015, and you know, admittedly, nothing's ever happened with that book apart from, I think Liz has seen it and thinks it's terrible, but that's beside the point.
I made recommendations.
But the point is, I just sort of thought, right, that's it. I'm going to go and I'm going to sit in a room and I'm going to just write for a bit. So I sort of got into the habit of being able to some extent, being able to write when there's other stuff going on. But I do find noise. Not general noise. I find I can't listen to music. I can't listen to people chattering. I really can't listen to teenagers doing video games and shouting and do it. So I tend to, if I have to sort of block something out, I listen to mynoise.net and get it on. And this is going to sound very ironic because it actually hasn't stopped raining since December down in Dorset. But I listen to Rain on a Tent or train noises because I can write on a train regardless of how busy it is. Don't ask me why. So do I have a routine? I'm partially retired now, so I do try and write on the days when I'm not working. And I would probably say that I'm naturally a 10 till 4 person. Generally, that's when I'm awake and that's when I'd probably be writing. So what I'm bad at doing when I'm not doing it with Liz, when I'm doing it with Liz, I will just sit down and finish. What I'm on my own, I will sort of probably look at the previous day's chapter and think, oh, I want to tweak that a little bit and tweak it, and then sort of like, oh, I've lost half an hour. So, you know, then you just have to sort of focus and get on with it, really.
Yeah. Time rushes away with you sometimes when you're... Do you find it, Liz? Or do you have a time limit where you think, I'm going to write for an hour, and then you get on with all the... You go
for your walks, don't you? Yeah, of course. You know, if I'm getting to the end of my loop, that's, you know, I know I'm sort of at the point where I should be probably getting to an end, unless it's like, well, I've got a lot more to say, I'm going to have to edit this down. So I might do it as an extra bit. So, yes.
Yeah.
I've never gone around twice.
I wish I could do that. I can dictate so many more words than I can write in this. I mean, I can type quite fast, but my brain doesn't work right. So it comes out, doesn't come out the same thing. And I spend more time editing it than I do reading it.
And also, I did try that, Laura, yeah, and it didn't work for me either.
And I've also got a character called Fox, and dictating that can come up with some very interesting things.
You have to call him something else and then do a find.
Yeah, then you have to remember. I did have to do that with somebody, and I used to call him Tulip or Rhino or something like that, so that because his name was just coming out as something else. Poor Maud kept coming out as Mode. And I just gave up. I just thought you're just gonna have to sit there and slog away at a typewriter.
So which was your, apart from your short stories, what did you say?
Yeah,
you
started off with short stories.
I
did a load of short stories, and I did a selection of them, and then I did NaNoWriMo, which is where you write a 50,000 words in 1 month. And I had enjoyed the discipline of it so much that I thought, I'd like to do the same thing through December, but I don't want to write a novel, partly because I couldn't think of an idea. I thought, let's do an advent calendar. And I thought of all the pictures you used to have behind advent calendars back in the day before chocolate. And I screwed them up and put them in a little jar. And every day I'd pull one out and write a story about it. It didn't matter what it was. I just had to write a story about it. And I did that, and I ended up with a book called The Advent Calendar.
Yeah,
I've
got
it. And, thank you. And there's all sorts of things in there. I decided I'd try and write something that there was serious stuff, funny stuff, silly stuff, a couple of true bits, or things that were based on true things, and incorporating going to London with us. This is before COVID, with a stinking cold and wishing you were dead on the way, and everybody else is coughing and sneezing on the train and all of that sort of thing. So that sounds disgusting, but it's really about sort of being so woozy. All of a sudden you sit down in a cafe and you're thinking about all the things you could have been doing if you'd made different decisions at different parts of your life. It just sounds very deep, and it isn't. So I moved on from that, and then the next thing I wrote was a memoir about my dad. And I had, there was a reason behind it. I had actually, in that period when I wasn't writing very much, had written two short stories about my dad and my mum. And the reason had been is that my father used to write a lot, and he'd said, and he used to write the weirdest, most wonderful things, but they were just mad. And I said, why didn't you write about something, you know, that people recognise? And he said, who wants to read a story about a pensioner in a mobility scooter and his pensioner wife? So I wrote them a detective story with a pensioner in a mobility scooter and his pensioner wife. And then I wrote another one, not a detective story, but another story about them. And I thought, right, I'm going to write a series of these. And I was in the middle of writing when my dad got very ill. And then I just got too sad to finish it. But afterwards I thought, and while he was ill, I was also writing down how I was feeling, as if it was happening to somebody else. It was how I was coping with the grief and all of that. And I was writing that down as if it was happening to somebody else. And then afterwards I thought, do you know what? I'm going to pull all these together, and I'm going to bring back up some memories of when we were children, and when, you know, when your dad is from my family anyway, my dad was my hero for a bit until I got to be a teenager. And then, of course, you get to be an adult and you just think, oh, that just dad, you're just so embarrassing, and all the rest of it. And I would sort of, it sounds really mad, but I tried to pull all of those elements together, the sort of going through dealing with an elderly parent who's dying, remembering when you were a child, and then these mad adventures that I was imagining my father dreaming while he's in a coma, that he's dreaming these mad adventures with my mum and my children who were little at the time. And and I pulled it all together into a memoir and gave it to my mum for a 70th birthday, I think. So
well, I think that's a beautiful thing to do, actually. Did you find it cathartic, or did it upset you, or?
No, it didn't. I'd written down the bits that I wrote about him being ill. I'd written down already, and though that had been cathartic, like I said, it was in the third person, so it's like it was happening to somebody else. The bits about the mad stories, the sort of like the fantasy, they were just great fun, and it was really nice sort of thinking, here's my dad in it, because he used to do things like just go down the middle of the street and the road in his mobility scooter, me and my sister running after, dad, this is a corner, there's a car coming around the other way. Or he'd go into a shop and tell them they needed a step or something like that. So he was all a bit nutty. So that was quite good fun. And then the going back and picking out the bits about, because I picked 1 year, and obviously it wasn't really 1 year. There were elements from other years, but it was a very key year. And the funny thing is, my sister, when she reads it, she can't really remember that year because she was very little. And she didn't know how I felt because, you know, we'd moved house and we'd actually moved from England to Wales, and I was, you know, very lonely. And she didn't know that. And she said, I was really sad reading that's how you were. But there were bits about how my dad taught her how to read, and, you know, it's a celebration. And most people who read it will say, you know, there are sad elements, but bits of it is a celebration of a life and a love.
Yeah.
This is a lovely book.
I actually would like to read it now that you've said that. What about your historical murders? Which is any of your favourite? Have you got any favourite ones, or are they? Is it always the book you're writing at the time?
It's probably the book I just wrote.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
Through the pain.
The pain of the work you're writing at the moment. Yeah. The next one then was Murder Britannica. And that had started as a paragraph I wrote in my lunch break once when it was raining and I couldn't go out. And I was imagining a really annoying elderly Roman woman talking to her irritated... it was a niece, I think, originally, but then later daughter-in-law, and basically telling her all the things she was doing wrong, including not having given her a grandson and all the rest of it. And the young woman having murderous thoughts. And that was all it was, really. And I thought, you know what, I'd really like to write one of those like 1920s golden era murder mysteries where everybody's fundamentally a suspect, everybody's fairly horrible, and nobody really cares about the victim because they're more bothered about whether the cocktail cabinets ran out of whiskey or that sort of thing, you know. And I thought it'd be really nice to just do something like that, but set it in the Roman era. And then I thought, well, I actually don't know a lot about Rome itself other than things I've read. But I do know about Britain and British people. And so I set it in South Wales because my mother-in-law, who's a big murder mystery fan, is in South Wales. The matriarch, my mother-in-law's lovely, but so it was a bit of an in-joke, really, that this mother-in-law's really horrible. And she's the matriarch of this family, this completely dysfunctional British family who's using the Romans for everything they can. And she just wants to get richer. And she's decided she's going to build a bath complex. Because she's found a spring, which is just a dribble of water, but she's decided there's been a goddess in her history, and she's bigging it all up because she's just going to get rich out of it, and then the murders start happening. So I did it, and it was really, it's a first novel, structurally not brilliant, but it was great fun, and I did it for my mother-in-law as a present and all the rest of it. And it's a bit of a Marmite book. Some people absolutely hate it, and other people really love it. And the people who really loved it said, what happens next? So then I wrote down. So then I moved the action to Dorset because I live here, and I thought, oh, that's great, I can market it. And that was autumn 2019. So that was the end of it. Yes, so.
We're all pre and post COVID now when we're talking, aren't we? You know, that's the thing.
And your books are quite lengthy. But this is me coming from an author. I only write about 50,000 words in my book.
Yeah, mine, I think Murder Britannica is about 60, but all the rest are between 80 and 90 or thereabouts. Yeah.
And how long would it take you to write one of... Let's go in the middle. Let's say 70,000 words.
If I actually sat down and wrote it, it wouldn't take that long, really. I think that they tend to be about a year apart. I think the Murder Britannica books are a bit closer together for various reasons, but they're around about a year apart, not because it takes me that long to write them, but because I usually end up with moving things around or changing things or editing them quite heavily, because I usually end up... I mean, I think the last Margaret book before it went to Liz was 130,000 words. So I had to strip out a lot. And it was, I think, I can't remember how long it was when I did send it, but I think it's probably nearer 100. So, you know, I end up having to edit a lot out. And so it does take me a while.
So... tell us about your Margaret books.
Okay.
Margaret Demaray.
So if you were listening to the last time I was your guest, we were talking about the co-written book, The Case of the Black Tulips and the Castor and Fleet series. And in the Castor and Fleet series, the character Catherine Demaray has a young sister called Margaret. Margaret, at the beginning of it, is a teenager. She's fed up because her family is poor. I mean, she's fed up because she's a teenager, but she's fed up because her family is poor. She's, you know, she's can't do the things she thinks she ought to be able to do, but she's pretty much convinced that all she really needs to do is sort of like lull around and hopefully the family will get rich and then she can find a rich husband and live in luxury. And then her sister starts to, you know, just rebel and just do her own thing, and she's got this detective thing going on, and Margaret realises that there's more to life than just sitting around going dancing and getting married, although she does like doing both of those things, but that's beside the point. And she decides she goes to university, then realises she's not going to get a degree, and decided to go into medicine as well. So that's sort of where we left her in Castor and Fleet. She's very much a side character, but she's sort of there. But when we finished the series, she sort of went pretty much, well, I'll say knocked on my door. That sounds a bit too demure for Margaret. She sort of hammered on the door and said, hang on a minute, what about me? What's happened to me? And I thought, yeah, I do want to know what happened to you. But I didn't set it straight after Castor and Fleet. I left it till 1910 in the lead up to the First World War. And it was partly triggered by something on a TV programme called Back in Time for School, where they were talking about in this particular, what was going on in schools. And in 1910, they were having the Empire celebrations because everything was really fantastic. But they were also training boys to fight because they knew there was going to be a war coming. And that was part of the I thought, this is a really interesting period to write about. Plus, the fashion's lovely. Going back to talking about clothes again.
Clothes come back, yeah.
Yeah, so okay. So there she is, there's Margaret. It's 1910, she's 36, she's widowed. She's working in a hospital for the poor, being patronised by men left, right and centre. What happens next? And what happens next is she meets a stranger who asks her to divulge hospital information, and she decides to do so.
Ooh. Because the first book's the wrong sort to die, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
Yes. It is a cracking read, I must say. But what are there any difficulties in writing a spin-off from an existing series?
I think because there was a gap between, it helped because I didn't have to worry too much about overlapping stuff. And remembering what Catherine might be doing, because it's her sister, obviously, remembering what Catherine might was doing literally at that moment when she was doing something else. But Catherine Catherine and Connie both get mentioned in the later book, so does some of the other family members. Although they're not intrinsic to the plot, they're there. Difficulties, I suppose, trying to be consistent, really, remembering who everybody is, how old they are.
Yes. Yeah, sometimes we're horrified that. They'd be this old, you know.
Do you do a lot of plotting then when you're writing your murder mystery type things?
I do an outline, and I usually know what's going to happen at the end. I know what's happening in the beginning. I know what's roughly what's the middle, you know, the sort of like the point where things split off are. And I know what the end is usually. I don't always, some of the detail in between can be a bit sketchy because the Margaret's books are set very specifically at a certain period and sometimes relate to specific historical events. I have to consider that as well because I have to work out where those would fit into the plot. The outline, then I do it more and more detailed. There is still a lot of fudgy, so I tend to be quite detailed up to the midpoint. The second half tends to be a little bit more free-flowing because I might have decided to change direction, because that's how I work. When I'm working with Liz, I don't work like that, but I do on my own, which is why it tends to slow down a little bit in the second half, because I'm sort of trying to pull lots of threads together.
Yeah, my characters tend to tell me where to go in a nice way, of course.
Yeah. How would you describe Margaret as a person?
I think she's a very determined person. I think she's got a vulnerability that I don't think is apparent to other people. She's quite outgoing. She's got lots of friends. She likes going to. She loves dancing. But she's passionate about social reform. She's passionate about getting the vote, about the treatment of the poor, about workers' rights, about not just women getting the vote, but also all men. So universal franchise. She's a very passionate person. Sometimes the passion comes out as belligerence or rudeness when perhaps she doesn't mean to. I think she protects herself to a certain extent because her first husband broke her heart, so she does try and she protects herself. So again, she can be a bit prickly on the outside, but underneath she's a very loving and caring person, and a very loyal friend. And she will, do anything for her friends, which is why she sometimes gets a bit conflicted when she doesn't always agree with her friends. So one of her friends is a militant suffragette, and she's not quite so sure that she agrees with the militancy. So there's, she's conflicted, but she's still loyal. I would love to have her as a friend. I think she'd be good fun, but she'd probably get frustrated because I can't dance.
So she's a feminist.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh yeah, very much so.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she's sorry.
Sorry, no, I was going to say, have you got anything from one of those books that you'd like to read out?
Right, well, I'm going to read, this is from the very first one, and this is when, I'm trying to think out the third, I think third time, she meets the man who's asked her for this information. She's given him the information because he's indicated to her that he cares about the poor, and the person that died was a pauper who'd been found in an alley, and died under odd circumstances, but it's like nobody really cares. And because she does care, she thinks maybe he can do something about it. So she's decided to give it to him. So I will read a bit of this. And she doesn't know him. He's somebody she's sort of met a couple of times, apparently by accident. He's then asking what had come out of the autopsy. She's a... She works in the pathology department, so she does autopsies and so on and so forth. I can't tell you more, she said. I've probably said more than I should have already. But the poor man may have gone to this grave under a name that wasn't his, and that always seems so cruel somehow. The workhouse said he was a tramp, but it's possible he wasn't. No one local knew who he was. There was nothing to confirm his identity. If it helps, I believed he died very quickly. Painlessly? Margaret stared into her cup and then looked up again. No. I didn't realise you were sentimental, Dr. Demery, said Fox, angling the sketch. The light behind him made his hair bright, as if he had a halo. Margaret realised he was a strawberry blonde, the apparent darkness an illusion caused by whatever he oiled his hair with. Little reddish curls had escaped. His greenish eyes met hers, and he tipped his head on one side, as if to prompt a response. I'm not, she replied, taking her book from him, their fingers touching for a moment. But I do care. I'm fully aware that the bodies I work on were once people and deserve respect. It's why you do it, isn't it? How do you mean? You want a better world for the poor. You want to prove living conditions are killing them. It won't be hard to find out what your political leanings are or your views on suffrage. Margaret's sense of discomfort increased. I'm sorry I couldn't help you, she said. And this has been very nice, but I must go. How much is my share? I wouldn't dream of letting a lady pay. And I wouldn't dream of being paid for by a stranger. Margaret stood up rather more abruptly than her ribs would have liked and tried not to wince. Fox rose too. I do hope you'll find your friend and that all is well with him. Perhaps another hospital. He wasn't my friend, said Fox, but I am interested in his fate. Eli Cann, for want of another name, may have been him. What did he die from? Phthisis, that is, tuberculosis. I know what phthisis is. Was that all? I don't associate that with a quick death. His lungs were extensively damaged by a number of things. Margaret put her sketchbook away and withdrew her purse. Did they smell of anything unexpected? Margaret paused with a frown. She could recall nothing in particular above the general smells of the laboratory, disinfectant, formaldehyde and decay, together with whatever scents wafted in from the hot city outside the window, people, horses, fumes. She shook her head and held out her hand. Goodbye, Fox. As I say, I hope you find what you seek. It's quite simple, Dr. Demery, said Fox. I want to know what killed him and who killed him.
Ah, so this person is suspecting that person's been murdered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something then, Mike? Did I interrupt your train of thought?
No, I enjoyed that.
Yes, I did very much. Mm-hmm. And people don't realise that pathology was going on, back in the day. Mm-hmm. I was doing some research into it a while ago, and it was, there was... quite big, and the thing is, with both world wars, medicine, pathology, etc., took massive leaps forward because of what was going on in the field hospitals, etc. So did you do a lot of research into the pathology side as at the time that you know for
this time? This particular incident clashes very much with the Dr. Crippen case. So in a hospital not very far away, there's a famous pathologist sort of working on that case. So, and at one point she's, you know, they, somebody suggests, well, if you won't do this, then perhaps we'll go and find him to do it instead, or a man to do it. The things that you find out when you start researching is astonishing, including the fact that there were female detectives. She never becomes a detective, she gets involved in detecting, but she remains a doctor. But there were female detectives, late Victorian and Edwardian times, that were actually advertising their wares. So, you know, they were, the things you don't know about women is quite amazing. And yeah, forensics, I have to sort of like dig around and try and work out, you know, what it would look like if somebody had been killed in a certain way. And I've got no medical background whatsoever, so it's takes some time sometimes.
Yeah, because it's very often smells, and cyanide's got a certain smell, and arsenic's got a certain smell, and these were the poisons of the day, weren't they? You know, they were used a lot, especially in your books.
Sorry, just talking about autopsy, that just reminded me that my wife and I were in London when my son, younger son, lived in London, and he took us to near Notting. Where Karl Marx is buried.
Oh, Highgate.
Highgate. Yes. Yeah. And there's a big common near there, which I can't remember the name of.
Yeah.
But anyway, went up there, found a pub, and there's a fascinating sign inside the pub to say that's where the first autopsy took place.
In the pub?
In the pub.
Okay.
And, yeah,
they fortunately moved on from that point. But fingerprinting, for example, was still relatively new. So the local copper, you know, when she gets burgled, is I don't know why we're bothering with this, because it's just, you know, it's been going for a few years, but it's not massively new. And, you know, it's just knowing what was available to them, trying to work out. It's obviously late enough that they would have a cold room to keep things in, but it's, you know, it's interesting. Really?
Yeah, because the fingerprints, they actually just look through big magnifying glasses to see if the swirls matched, you know. And I did a project on this, and I'd have a headache by the time I'd finished. But yeah, you could actually match up different people's fingerprints.
So, do you have any kind of future projects in mind?
Well, I'm on working on the fifth. Margaret Demaret at the moment. It's late 1913. The idea is the sixth one will be 1914, and so the series will finish when World War One breaks out. What happens to Margaret after that, it will probably be again one of those things where I'll let her sort of have a bit of, well, she'll probably have a rest because she'll be busy during World War One. But you know, from my perspective, you know, just leave it lie for a bit while I decide what I want to do. So apart from possible projects working with you, Liz, I have potentially, I haven't quite made my mind up whether I'd have a series on the home front in World War One, which I quite like to do, or one in the 1920s, say, after the war. It would be lovely to be able to do something in Dorset. But it is quite a quiet county, it's knowing what to do. Obviously, with a home front in a city, you've got a lot more going on. You've got Zeppelin raids and so on and so forth. So, I'm still busy, sort of like in 1913 at the moment. So it's a bit difficult to think.
You need some spies, Paul. You need some spies hanging around that area, looking for places where the enemy can.
Yes. Oh, there's plenty of we got Weymouth, for example. There were torpedoes, they were making they did make missiles in Weymouth, and they had they actually used it. Well, I think they still do, but they certainly did. They took a big ship out there and just shot things at it. Made sure this is before the war. Made sure the Germans knew they were doing it. Reported it all in the press so that they could say this is how good our torpedoes are. They just sank one of their own ships. So yeah, it was yeah. There's lots of potential, but yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to end this with you've got plenty of ammunition to go out there.
Oh,
sorry about that. Can I just thank you so much for being a guest again, and we've really thoroughly enjoyed listening to you and all about your writings, etc. So thank you. And that brings this episode to a close. So from us all here, have a nice Thursday evening. Bye.
Bye.
You have been listening to Only Murders in My Mind, a Random Thought production, produced by John Bissett. The music, In Peril, was composed and recorded by OM Studio Strings.